Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC, as we interview the interviewers today, right now, Tom Brokaw, the longtime NBC nightly news anchor and author of the book The Greatest Generation, has a new book called Times of Our Lives, A Conversation About America, in which he calls on Americans to reenlist as citizens and proposes a United States Academy of Public Service. Tom, I so appreciate you coming in. Welcome back to WNYC.
My pleasure, Brian.
And let's get right to the heart of the matter of your book. If the greatest generation did so much with a sense of national purpose during the Great Depression and World War II, is that what you see missing so badly as we fret about our economic future today?
I do think it is missing, and I've tried to understand why. I think some of it is an abstract. The national debt doesn't wake up – you don't wake up every morning and hit you in the face. You know, it's out there. It's a huge debt. But unless it affects you directly in some way, it seems to be off in the distance in some fashion. And I also think that – and this is not unusual for any society – we're inclined to live on the past rather than in the future. We've always thought, well, we'll cycle out of this and we'll come back again. But objectively, world conditions have changed. We have China and India and Brazil and Russia now as our competitors. And we are on such a spending binge. And when it collapsed, the consequences were very great. So I really do think it's time for people to reevaluate their own lives and step up and say, what do I want to leave behind here?
And we feel the government's debt in our tax rates that right. prompted the outrage of the Tea Party. We feel it in the new debates over what kind of austerity we're going to have. We feel our personal debt in the collapse of the housing bubble, obviously, so everybody's feeling it. When you say it's time to reenlist as citizens, what do you mean?
Well, by that I mean step into the arena and get involved in the politics of our time. I have been saying about the Tea Party, love them or hate them, the fact is they got angry, they got organized, and they got to Washington, and they've stayed on message and they've stayed disciplined. So they're having an enormous impact on the Republican presidential nomination race, probably out of proportion to their numbers. If you look at most of the national polling, their numbers are not that great in terms of people who see themselves as either Tea Party members or who embrace their positions. But because they have a strong sense of what it is that they want and the discipline to stay with that, they are having an impact.
What about Occupy Wall Street? Do you see them as a left equivalent of the Tea Party?
Not yet, in part because I think that they need more definition. I mean, I understand the rage. I don't think Wall Street has it coming in so many ways. But at the same time, it's hard to get a kind of linear idea of where they want to go and how they want to get there. So it's rage without definition, in my judgment.
When we were attacked on 9/11, we sent the volunteer army, obviously, into Afghanistan and then Iraq. And President Bush told the rest of us to go about business as usual and to go shopping. And Bush has long been ridiculed by Democrats for that. I don't think you mentioned this specifically in the book. But was that a shocking thing to you? And I don't mean about Bush as an individual, but about the country compared to World War II.
Yeah, we forgot the lessons of Vietnam, for one thing. We went to war on a credit card. We thought we could have guns and butter and that we could send less than 1% of our population to take 100% of the bullets and the IEDs, and the rest of us didn't even have to think about the war. I think that was a big mistake. And I think that President Bush could have done more to rally the country, but I also think Democrats could have stepped up on that and saying, wait a minute, we can't ask the working class and the middle class of this country to volunteer without the rest of us making some kind of a sacrifice and putting the pressure on.
Is some of it just that the economics of war are different today? Maybe the greatest generation needed to ration things and sacrifice commercial right. production for military production because that was what an industrial war demanded. Maybe today our post-industrial economy and post-industrial warfare demand something else. I don't know.
Well, this war is a lot more expensive than we were told it was going to be. You remember Paul Wolfowitz thought that we could recover a lot of the cost from the Iraqi oil revenue. That has not turned out to be the case. We've spent more than $1 trillion on these two wars. That's without getting into the wisdom of the military strategy or the political goals. But I do think that we have to examine the cost of all of that, both in lives lost and bodies battered and the emotional distress, and also the bottom line when it comes to what we can afford and what we can pay for.
Let me ask you about your proposal for a United States Academy of Public Service. It would be a collection of academies, really, modeled on West Point and the other prestigious military academies. What do you have in mind?
Well, what I have in mind is to elevate the idea of public service. We have a lot of great programs in America, Teach for America, the Peace Corps, the America Corps, but they seem to be less than the sum of their parts. And what I've done, in a way, here is take the Israeli model. They put everybody into the IDF, into the Israeli Defense Forces, and there have been a number of studies that have demonstrated that that gives the country a lift because young people learn discipline and risk management, and they gain maturity when they're in the service. They come out, they go to college. By the time they're 23 or 24, they really are 32 or 33 in terms of real experience. So my idea for a public service academy is to take, and this is an idea still in formation, take, say, six academies across the country, attach them to land-grant schools. Cornell's a land-grant school, Colorado State, Berkeley. And then make them public-private partnerships. Develop the Johnson & Johnson Fellow in Medicine, the Caterpillar Fellow in Third World Construction. And they make a deal with those companies. The companies get some tax credits for underwriting this program. They go off to distant parts of the world or work here on projects. And at the end of 3 years of national service, they go back to their company, and they've got 2 or 3 years to prove themselves within the corporation. If it doesn't work out, they then go on about their business. I do think it would help us address a lot of the skill set that we need to improve in this country. Most manufacturers and other companies say we need to get better trained people. We're coming out of, you know, as you know, they're coming out of high school with not the literary or math skills that they need for the modern workplace.
We're so behind.
So it's a big, bold idea, and I'm just trying to – what I'm trying to do, Brian, really is gin up the conversation about it.
Absolutely. Well, here's Philip in New Jersey who wants to react to that. Hi, Philip. You're on WNYC.
Actually, it's a slightly different thing. It's wondering about the reality or maybe even the wisdom of doing basically like a required national vote. In other words, either incentivizing it through a tax break or through a fine.
Well, you're talking about mandatory voting.
Mandatory voting, yeah, essentially would cause to neuter a lot of the sort of extremist positions in politics nationally.
Right. Okay, forgive me. I thought you were calling up to talk about mandatory national service. Have you ever thought about mandatory voting? Have you ever looked at the countries that have it, like Australia?
I have, and I think that the decision not to vote is a political choice as well, and that we ought not to deny people the opportunity to say, I don't like any of them, so I'm not going to the polls today. I don't think mandatory. I think it's counterintuitive to free choice and to the idea of personal liberty.
And yet there are so many people who don't vote in this country. When you look at the percentage of people who could register or who are registered and could vote, that actually elect or elected officials, it's kind of scary.
So get me started on this. Some time ago at Harvard at the Kennedy School, I made a proposal that we change everything. We vote on Tuesdays, which, first of all, comes on a work day. It's very hard. States have there are myriad rules for registration and where you can vote and whether it's transportable or not. So what I would like to do, and this will never happen, of course, what I would like to do is have voting start on Friday at noon in New York and whatever it is in Hawaii at the time, I guess 7 in the morning, go on 24 hours until Sunday. You vote electronically with a card, just like an ATM card or something like that. And we can't make a projection because we can't see the returns. We can't really do appropriate exit polls.
We the media.
We the media. By Sunday at 6 o'clock New York time, all the polls closed. There's an electronic tabulation. Everyone has been involved. They voted at shopping centers and football stadia and wherever they happen to be. And then there's a huge party in America as they sit to wait for these results to come in. I think that would pull people into the process. Andy Young, the lieutenant for Dr. Martin Luther King, has got a program called Why Tuesday, because he thinks it does penalize the working class people that they can't always get to the polls.
Tom Brokaw, my guest on WNYC, with his new book, Times of Our Lives, A Conversation About America. And Avi in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Avi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, you're on the air.
Good. I had a quick question about sort of the way the structure of a public academy for public service. I think it's a really interesting idea. I think it's a really great way to sort of motivate people to want to join public service and do that sort of thing. But I did have a quick question or sort of a concern about the way that it might be structured or the way that it might sort of add a kind of a bureaucratic class to the current system. As we, naval academies, academies for the armed services, and that sort of creates kind of an officer class. Would that be a concern of yours, as it might be of mine, to create sort of a public service officer class, like an elite sort of, because I know in other countries they have, tests you can take and sort of enter into the public service sector. I guess I wondered if that would be an issue or concern, but overall I'm kind of cool with it, and I'm a huge fan. So
no, not necessarily an officer class. I think that there's a real need for grunts, if you will, to borrow a military term. If you take, for example, public academy and construction skills, take some young man or some young woman who may not want to go to a four-year college or an institution and study the humanities and literature, but has a real feel for machinery and likes to fix things and build things and maybe wants to be a new kind of an electrical contractor. I was on the USS John Stennis, which is one of our nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, a few years ago, and I would down in the bowels of the ship. And after these young men and women came off duty, all of them just high school graduates, they would go and work on their computers, on the problems that fascinated them. They were fixing the electronics in the ship. You've got to have a ground-up population as well as a top-down population, and I think we've got to give the ground-up population more opportunity.
For sure. President Clinton, as you know, proposed a form of national service, and it got watered down into AmeriCorps because Congress wouldn't fund anything more ambitious. John McCain believed in something like that, too, when he ran for president, but didn't even bother to emphasize it because it wouldn't be popular enough. Do you think your idea could succeed politically on this mass basis?
I don't know, but I think that we're at a stage in our lives when we have to try big ideas again, big, bold ideas. And one of the best ideas for this came from, I was talking to a man in Texas by the name of Bob McNair, who owns the Houston Texans, very successful entrepreneur in the power business first, conservative. And when I rolled this out for him, he said, make it public-private. He said, get the private sector involved. And I thought, bingo, that's a great idea. That may help not just with the funding but with the idea of it.
Yes, although I could see where people wouldn't trust a GE public-private partnership with the government, which is one of the ones on the list in the book, or a Johnson & Johnson, thinking they're going to use this for their own purposes, not for public purposes.
Well, that's okay. They use it for their own purposes after 3 years of public service. They sponsor the public service first for 3 years. Then they get a well-trained employee back at the end of 3 years who has 2 years or 3 years to prove himself or herself to the corporate world.
And then they get a shot at jobs with those companies as well. One thing along these lines that interested me from the book, since Vietnam, nobody wants to bring back the draft, and I don't think you do either. But you remind—
I'll tell you who really doesn't. The military doesn't want it back.
That's right, because they feel they have the most professional force they've ever
they've
had.
They've got motivated young men and women.
Absolutely. But you remind us that for your generation, the draft card issued to boys when they turned 18 was a silent reminder that you owe your country military service. So do you think something significant was lost as well as gained when the draft was ended in the 70s?
I do. I do. In my case, actually there was a blogger today who took me on saying, well, he never served in the service in the military, even though he wrote about the greatest generation. I tried desperately to enlist in the Navy OCS program, and I volunteered for the draft in the Army. I had flat feet. Of all things, I'd been an athlete.
You got a 4F on flat feet?
I got a 1Y, in case of national emergencies, they'll call me up. But all of my friends at that time, and they were all males, women were not eligible for the draft, all of my friends, we knew that that was going to be a part of our plan for life. They were either in ROTC or making arrangements to join the Navy or the Marine Corps or something else, and that was just a fixed part of who we were.
Tom Brokaw, his new book, Times of Our Lives, A Conversation About America. More with Tom Brokaw in a minute.
Had the time of my life, and I never felt this way before, and I swear this is true. And
Tom Brokaw, our guest on WNYC, his new book, Times of Our Lives, A Conversation About America. You know, for all the journalism that you've done for NBC, the one thing you'll probably be most remembered for, I think it's fair to say, is coining the term the greatest generation. Do you agree?
I did.
Was it your phrase?
Here's a very abbreviated idea of how it came about. I went to the 40th anniversary of D-Day, and I really went over there thinking, yeah, I don't have great food in the north of France, and on the beach I was training for a marathon I'll be able to run. And it changed my life because I was with all these veterans. And I began collecting their stories informally. And by the time of the 50th anniversary, I was on the air with Katie Couric in the morning on the Today Show. And she said, what do you think? And I said, they survived the Depression, won the war, came home and gave us the lives we have today. I think it's the greatest generation any society ever produced. And when I finished, Steve Ambrose came over to me and hammered me on the back. And he said, if you don't write that, I will. So I did, and there was I started collecting the stories and writing the book, and then there was a kind of not a dispute so much. There was a big discussion at Random House and within my friends about should I go that far and call it the greatest generation. And my line has always been that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
I know some baby boomers who resent the term. They say, Sure, the generation stared down the hardships of the Great Depression and World War II. They were great and admirable, but every generation has its own set of challenges unique to its time.
There was nothing like World War II or the Great Depression from a domestic point of view and from an international point of view. World War II, the future of the planet was at stake. We fought on 6 of the 7 continents. 50 million people perished before it was all over. People, I think, of this generation have no realization clearly of how far advanced Nazism was in Europe. They'd conquered France at that point. They were trying to move on Russia. We owe a lot to Russia for holding them off, frankly. They'd conquered the Balkans, and they were in Scandinavia, and they were trying desperately to get Britain as a launching pad to get here at some point, to say nothing of what was going on in the Pacific. We were the 16th military power in the world in 1939, and by 1941, we're in a world war. Think about how we had to ramp up and what we had to do and what we had to give up at home. So I do think that that generation – and then that generation came back – and a lot of the African-Americans who served honorably and in combat said, we're not going to take the kind of racism that we've experienced at home anymore. And they were the underpinning of what Dr. King was able to do in so many ways.
Though the baby boom would say, yeah, your generation, that generation, ignored civil rights and women's rights and other forms of oppression that then they dealt with as the challenge of their times.
Betty Friedan was a member of the Greatest Generation, and no one put the role of feminism on the table more aggressively or more persuasively than Betty did, in my judgment. Also, the Supreme Court, made up of members of that generation, gave us Brown versus Topeka Board of Education. So it was an imperfect generation. There's no question about that. There were a lot of people. I mean, George Wallace was a member of that generation. He'd performed heroically in World War II.
But so is Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
Continuing the generational conversation, I think. Andy in Boonton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Andy.
Oh, thank you so much, Brian. And it's great to be on the phone with Tom Brokaw, too. Thank you so much for your service to the country.
Oh, thank you.
I just wanted to say a couple of quick things, because I've been reading this great book, Millennial Momentum, and it really talks about the generation that I'm a part of and touches on a lot of what you're talking about, that AmeriCorps, even though it's watered down, its applications were up 2.5%. Teach for America's up. There's more applicants than our spots for this. And it'd be great as a high school teacher to be able to say without whispering to my students that there's an option other than college. If you're not sure what you want to do and you want to serve your country, you want to get skills based on what your interests are. So since Clinton failed, could Obama use his new idea for an executive order to at least establish a framework and then maybe let public-private partnerships take over some type of National Service Corps at the local level?
Well, I think not just President Obama, but the Republican candidates as well could begin the dialogue. We're not going to get it done. Not much is going to get done before the election of 2012. But what I'm trying to do is to start a conversation about it, try to get people to think in new and bold ways about how we can address some of these issues that plainly need addressing in this country.
Do you think that for today's young people, given the challenges that we're facing, the post 9/11 world and the post bubble world, that there's a kind of parallel with the greatest generation in terms of what it's staring down?
Again, the problem is, Brian, it's not in front of their face as World War II was. You know, when Pearl Harbor was attacked, pacifists became militant overnight because the United States had been attacked. We didn't take advantage in a political way of what happened after 9/11. This country was united to a degree that I had not seen in a long time after 9/11, and then it just kind of faded away, and it was out of sight, out of mind when it came to the wars. I do think that this generation, I've been spending time on the so-called millennials, many of whom are going home to live with their families because they can trust them and they can't afford to go into the marketplace, as it were. They're not getting jobs. They're seeing their fathers being let go by corporations after 20, 25 years at the desk or in a job of some kind. So they're skeptical about what this country is going to do for them.
Kurt in Morris County, you're on WNYC with Tom Brokaw. Hi, Kurt.
Oh, hello. Mr. Brokaw, and well, to both of you, I've watched the film Network recently, and I was struck by its eerie prescience. I was wondering your thoughts on how the echo chamber of modern the modern news media has influenced our political conversation in this country.
Kurt, thank you so much. Tom?
Well, for one thing, there's been a long, long, rich tradition of news media entertaining and being provocative. Everything from Thomas Paine to the newspapers in this city alone.
And opinionated.
In the 1950s, filled with tabloids. The most popular guy in America was Walter Winchell at one point. Dorothy Kilgallen was a headliner, if you will. What I say to people these days is we've never had more choices than we do now, and you have to be much more proactive as a consumer. Just this morning, I was listening to the BBC, for example, on Sirius. I can catch NPR. I can go online, read the Financial Times. I can read releases from the Saudi Foreign Ministry. I can read the local newspapers across the country and find out what's going on. Can't be a couch potato anymore. I say that in the book. You've got to get up every morning and say, is this reliable? Where did it come from? What are they attempting to do with what I'm reading here? And take that for what it is. You know, there were newsstands in New York City and Chicago and Los Angeles and all the major cities across the country that in 1953, 54, there'd be four or five editions out there, each with screaming headlines of one kind or another. And they were playing to the base instincts of their readership.
And yet the caller says it's the echo chamber of today's media. I don't know. I guess the question is, do you think it's somehow more powerful and more polarizing today because it's broadcast? Because at the same time that there were those screaming tabloids, and maybe that was only in the biggest cities, you know, even at the heyday of New York's tabloid culture, there were probably only a couple of newspapers in most of the place. I don't know what you grew up with in South Dakota in terms of newspapers. But then there were just the three major networks, at least for this blip in time from about 1950.
And those three major networks, as I've often said, I want to be a part of this, so I don't have any problem criticizing it. But those three major networks were controlled by white middle-aged men who lived on the eastern seaboard, and that was the prism through which they saw the world and presented to the rest of the country. There were no women. There were no people of color making these decisions. They weren't on the air at that time. We did a lot of wonderful work, and the Edward R. Murrows and the Walter Cronkites and Chet Huntley and David Brinkley and Reuben Franks of the world gave us a platform that we could build on. But I go back to my original point. You have to work harder. I think it's less about television, by the way, these days, in terms of an echo chamber, than it is about the Internet. That cannot be overstated in terms of its reach and its effect and its power.
And there's a big debate, too, about whether the Internet just winds up dividing people into their echo chambers. You can, you know, bookmark your favorites so that you're only seeing the news that tends to agree with your pre-existing point of view. I think there are also links all over the place that, you know, even if they're linked hostily by a particular blogger, let's say, that there's more opportunity to read things from different points of view than there ever was. But I don't know if you have an opinion.
I do. I think that there are we're hearing voices that we wouldn't have heard otherwise, and many of them give us insights that we wouldn't have seen otherwise. And I think that's part of the First Amendment. That was the whole idea of it, is that everybody has a voice in this country and they're free to express it. Now the megaphone is just that much larger. But again, as a news consumer, as a citizen, you have to be vigilant and you have to develop some tests, I suppose, for where you get it and how reliable it is and how credible it is for a long term.
And I'm glad that you framed the narrow control of the three major networks in their heyday in the way you did, because this is something that I've thought about too. I believe it or not, I worked for NBC for 7 years during some of your time there working for the radio network. And I think there's some misplaced nostalgia today for the heyday of the big three as being so dominant in our news culture, you know, that watching the aftermath of the Kennedy assassination or watching the moonwalk in the 1960s somehow so unified the country that that was a better media than they had today. I actually don't think so. And for the reasons that you said, is that your opinion? Too much nostalgia?
I think there's a lot of nostalgia. Now, I do give them full credit for creating what became a reliable and powerful source of important news. But it was Washington concentrated for the most part. We spent a lot of time in Europe, almost no time on China, for example, and almost no time on a lot of the issues in the flyover country, as they call it, where a lot of developments were going on economically. In the part of the world where I grew up, for example, agriculture has made enormous changes. It's a much different business than it was a long time ago. That's a very important story. Didn't get any attention.
Christina in Morris County. You're on WNYC with Tom Brokaw. Hi, Christina.
Hi. Thank you. I have a question about how to get active the way our society is currently set up, that either both parents have to work and there's just no time with longer working hours and everything, or you're unemployed and you can't afford really to be active, like $5,000 a plate to go meet with your representatives, or, you know, you write a letter, which, you know, when you get your response back, it's kind of, you just feel like you just got a computer-generated response back. And right now, the only way I feel, because I am unemployed, to be active is social media. I, you know, have lots of networks with people politically active online trying to spread information because we don't trust the mainstream media. But I want to know what else I can do. I mean, I feel kind of crippled because I can't afford to do much, but, you know, spread information online about, you know, what's going on. And for somebody in a situation, the average American, it seems like there's just, you know, no way to be really. That's why I think people are doing Occupy Wall Street. That's why, you know, I scrounged up a few bucks and was able to go one day, because people just feel like they don't know what to do. Our vote doesn't seem to matter because it's the less of two evils.
And you're already doing more than most people online, and then you say in person, and you still feel frustrated, Tom.
Yeah, totally. I feel like there's so much that needs to be done. And from what I see, social media, Occupy Wall Street is, and plus when I went, it's not just a bunch of kids. I'm 44. It's all across. I mean, it's World War II veterans are there. You know, it's a wide demographic that's not being shown in the mainstream. And it is online, though. You can find it. The only problem is there's so much vitriol that I started a page where it's trying to get moderates to speak to each other, and you still get people coming on and just fighting, and nobody wants to open up a discussion because there's so much division created, and that's, I think, part of the biggest problem. It just seems so bad. Like after 9/11, the division became so extreme that it's very. I opened this page a year ago, and
Christina,
I only had
would you send us? Would you email me a link to that page? I would love to see it. And we're trying to do somewhat of a similar thing on our politics website. It's afreecountry.org, creating a space, because there are no, as I think you're saying, there are no kind of passionately moderate hosts out there on the moderate channel on cable television, you know, being different from Fox or MSNBC, but with that kind of a message.
Just say one thing.
Sure.
It's united we stand, divided we fall. And we have to be united as a country. Even if we disagree on certain things, we need to be united, because it's really our country. Everyone is very concerned. That's why people are marching all over the country.
Thank you very much. Coming full circle to the theme of your book.
Well, I think that she represents what a lot of people are thinking. And it's across the political spectrum, by the way. I mean, I know people on the right who have no used for the choices that are before them at the moment, and they're very frustrated about the direction of the country as well as people on the left. I would say to her, get more definition in your movement, get specific goals, find a friend, have that friend find two friends, have that friend find three friends, and put together a movement. That's how you make change in America, and you get involved in the process. I said on Meet the Press yesterday, the problem is that we have an analog political culture and a digital world, and I think a lot of people are frustrated by the walls that have been set up, if you will, through money and through organization, and it's a closed system.
She dated it to 9/11 when people started talking past each other. I'm not sure. Do you think American politics, with your long history covering Washington, covering the nation and the world, that American politics are really more polarized today than earlier in your lifetime? Or do we in the media now just like to denounce it as such?
No, I think that the tools for polarization are more effective now than they were before. I covered 1968. You know, I was in Chicago. I was working in California. I saw polarization firsthand all day, every day. But it is more polarized now. And here's an example of it. I cite it in the book. I was in Washington, and two button-bright young men came up to me in blue suits, red ties. You would know the type. And they said, "Mr. Brokaw, we want to talk to you about the old days." And I think they meant 1996. I'm not sure. But one of them said, "I'm a Democrat. He's a Republican. He's my best friend. We go to Georgetown every night and argue politics. We both work for congressmen. He's a Republican, works for a Republican. I work for a Democrat. His boss won't talk to my boss. My boss won't talk to his boss." At the height of Watergate in Washington, people talked to each other. You know, at the end of the day, they'd get together and say, "How's this going to turn out? How do we move this country forward in some fashion?" That was going on even during the anti-war movement in the 1960s. Now, the two parties are so polarized that they go to separate corners and refuse to meet in the middle of the ring.
Tom Brokaw's new book is called Times of Our Lives, A Conversation About America. A great honor to have you on the show for so long today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.